From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with David Grosso. He is an at-large member of the D.C. Council. He's an independent. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the Current Newspapers. Tom, good to see
you. Good afternoon.
Joining us in the first part of the broadcast is Corey Stewart. He is the chairman of the Prince William Board of Supervisors and a Republican candidate for governor in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Corey Stewart, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, great to be on the show again, Tojo.
If you have questions or comments for Corey Stewart, start calling us at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org, shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show, or go to our website, kojoshow.org, watch the live video stream of the broadcast, ask a question, or make a comment there. Before we go directly to Corey Stewart, Tom Sherwood, in what you might say is a related issue, Congresswoman Barbara Comstock has decided that she is calling for an independent investigation into Russia's influence on the 2016 election, that on the heels of the firing by the president of FBI Director James Comey. She is joining a lot of Democrats and a few Republicans who are doing this. She is not supporting necessarily the president firing of Mr. Comey. Is this because of what her districts look like and the tight race she's likely to be in?
Well, I'd like to believe she's taking her position because that's what she thinks and stands for. But you remember,
forget
Barbara
what you'd like to believe. What do you actually believe?
Well, Barbara Comstock during the campaign last year was not very close to Donald Trump. In fact, was very careful of staying away from him. And like our guest, who will give him a chance to comment on this, she represents a conservative to moderate at best district here in Northern Virginia, and she has tried. She's taken great pains to maybe. Someone might call her an establishment Republican, to distance herself from the Trump effect that's going on now. And so that's what she's done. She's asked for an independent investigation. And she does have a suburban D.C. audience, which is filled with government workers and people who rely on the federal government. I always like to point out that Brookings Institution says for every federal worker, it creates 6 private sector jobs, whether you're talking about a fast food worker or any other person, a restaurant worker. And so it's very important to her district that she maintain this distance, arm's length distance, from all the troubles that people now see in the Trump campaign.
Corey Stewart, your Republican opponent, Ed Gillespie, former chair of the Republican Party, he took some heat this week for remaining silent on the firing of FBI Director James Comey. Should he be speaking out? And what are you saying about that fire?
Well, I fully support the president in trying to clean house and start with a fresh start. The FBI needs a fresh start. It's probably the most respected institution in the federal government, but it's taken a black eye over the past year, in large part because of the failure in leadership by Comey. And I think the president did the right thing. He needs to, and I'm not surprised at all, that the establishment in Washington, those Republicans and Democrats alike, are pushing back on Trump as he's trying to clean house and start. He's really the first outsider running for president since 1980. So I'm not surprised. As for so-called Republicans like Barbara Comstock, I mean, it's really unfortunate that we have all these establishment Republicans like Barbara, like Ed Gillespie, who will not stand and take a stand and fight and support the Republican president of the United States. And Barbara, it's just a real shame that she's not defending the president. It's not a surprise, though.
You obviously bear no ill will. You were fired by the Trump campaign during the last election campaign.
I don't. Trump has fired a lot of people. And, I'm one of them. But I stay loyal to him because I was loyal to the cause, and I'm loyal to him. I did what I did in October to support him because I didn't think the establishment was supporting him enough.
For people who don't know what you did, you participated in a demonstration outside of GOP headquarters because you didn't think the party was supporting Donald Trump sufficiently.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Well, can we? You're running for governor. The primary is June 13th. some of the polling shows you trailing by double digits significantly, Ed Gillespie, the establishment Republican you just made a reference to. What are you seeing now between now and the election that could possibly change things? I went back and looked at the election results from 2016, and Mr. Trump got 35% of the vote in Virginia's Republican primary. Marco Rubio got 32%. And in your home county of Prince William, Rubio got 33.5% to Mr. Trump's 33, virtually tied.
Mm-hmm.
Some people the Republican Party are saying, well, Virginia is really not a Trump state. It's more of a moderate Republican state, and you're too hard on the edge for Mr. Trump to win. What are you going to do between now and June 13th?
Well, first of all, all of the polling that's been done so far is old. And not only that, but it was of general election voters. It was of registered voters. And there was no filter. There's no screening for primary voters, which is a different kind of person. I mean, it's probably somewhere between 3 and 5% of the general electorate of the registered voters will actually vote in the Republican primary. What we're seeing on the ground in my campaign is a lot of support among new Republicans, people who came out and voted in the Republican primary and voted for Republican in many cases for the first time ever for Donald Trump. Those people, they wanted to drain the swamp in Washington. That's why they elected Trump. And they also recognize that there's an establishment, in fact, a very powerful establishment in Richmond that prevents anything happening in Richmond, any significant change. And they're out there and they're equally as determined to rid Virginia of the swamp of the Republican establishment as they were this past November, this last year. So I think we're going to win, and I think that we're going to surprise a lot of people.
And well, the polling certainly wasn't very good last year. But Mr. Gillespie is pretty much ignoring as kind of, the establishment leader of the party, getting all the endorsements, et cetera. Even the sheriff of your own county switched from you to him for a variety of reasons. But it seems like he's trying to minimize his appearances with you and just going to coast to a win on June 13th.
Well, not only minimize appearances with me, but he won't show up with gun owners. He didn't show up with VCDL.
With what?
With the Virginia Citizens Defense League. This is
okay,
the biggest gun rights group in Virginia, Second Amendment rights group. And he never showed up with Donald Trump, not a single rally, even though he was invited to show up with Donald Trump last year. He refused to do it.
To two or three myself.
Yeah, that's right. You're more of a Trump supporter than he is, I think. And he was asked to join this leadership team in October for the Trump campaign. Of all the Republicans who were asked, everyone said yes, except for Ed Gillespie. He won't touch Donald Trump. And I think that he thinks that that's going to be ignored and people are going to support him, even though he doesn't support the president. I think he's going to be in for a rough surprise on June the 13th, honestly.
Our guest is Corey Stewart. He is the chairman of the Prince William Board of Supervisors. He's a candidate for governor of Virginia. You can also join us on Facebook, where you'll see our Facebook live stream there. You can shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show or email to kojo@wamu.org. You've been making headlines recently defending Confederate monuments and memorials. You've said everyone should feel free to honor their heritage and their history. You took to Twitter to say there's nothing worse than a Yankee telling a Southerner his monuments don't matter. But the Twitterverse quickly reminded you that you were actually born in Duluth, Minnesota. Your home state actually helped the Union win the Civil War. Is your case less convincing given the fact that your Southern heritage
is
adopted?
You know, in fact, here's another one for you. I've never told anybody this, but my dad was a pallbearer for Wolson, who was the last surviving Civil War soldier from the Union. This is back in 1952 or something like that.
So explain yourself.
Yeah. So here's my position. For all these liberals who are saying, well, you're not a real Virginian because you weren't born in Virginia. I think that's ridiculous. I've been here for 20 years. My children were born here. I've built my business, my political career here. And would they say the same thing, that unless you were born in America, you're not a real American? By that logic, it makes no sense. Of course not. Look, I'm a Virginian by choice. I love this state. And one of the things that I love about Virginia, perhaps most importantly, I love its history. I love its heritage. I love the fact that it's the state of Washington and Madison and Jefferson. And yes, Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson and Jeb Stuart Our history is so important in Virginia. And when they start taking down statues, as they are in Charlottesville, of Robert E. Lee, and now the city has indicated its intent to take down the statue of Thomas Jefferson, this will spread because you have other localities, especially in Richmond, Williamsburg, etc., that will start taking down our statues, our memorials to great Virginians. And I think that when we lose that history and that heritage, we're losing a part of our identity. A very important part of it, and that's why I think it's so important.
But that focus on Confederate symbols has cost you the support of a longtime ally, Prince William County Sheriff Glendale Hill, along with four Republican county supervisors. What do you say to somebody like the sheriff who says, well, when you are celebrating your heritage, you're in fact celebrating my slavery?
Well, I, with all due respect to him, and I think he misunderstands.
Actually, I put those words
yeah.
in his mouth.
Yeah, I know. Okay. Yeah, I know. But I mean, but essentially it's this. Look. When you're trying to defend history, when you're trying to preserve our history, that doesn't mean that we're advocating for what the Confederacy supported, not by any stretch of the imagination. But you can't erase history, and as Condoleezza Rice said the other day, you cannot sanitize history. It is what it is, and if you try to erase it, you will forget it, and we don't want that to happen. So, and this is not about the Confederacy. It's not about the Confederate flag. This is about rampant political correctness that is shaming people for wanting to celebrate and honor their ancestors and their heritage. Men, you know, men and women who fought in the Civil War, fought honorably. And I just think that we should not be shaming them. And I wasn't born in the South. I don't have any ancestors that fought for the Confederacy. But I do think that it's wrong to be shaming in an entire section of our country for its history.
Maybe the better idea is to... I've said this about the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, that not to rename that bridge, but to make certain that the information, historical information on either side of that bridge explains what happened there so that you know what it was. Because if you do take off the name and then decades later people say, well, what's this bridge? What was it for? Yeah. And people won't know. And but on the other hand, there are a lot of Confederate memorials, and there aren't... Why not have new memorials, a better understanding of who those folks were and what happened and what they supported, slavery and all those different things, so people growing up can have a better understanding of who they are rather than tearing them down and put them in museums or something.
Well, go ahead, Stuart.
Yeah, I think the thing...
It's more complicated than just either leave them up or leave them down.
Well, the problem with museums are they're so dry, and most people don't go to museums, but when you have a memorial in a public park, and, you know, someone can go up to that and they can say, well, who's that? And then they start getting interested in history. That's why they're there in the public. And I think one of the reasons these memorials, you know, these were put up at a time when a lot of Confederate veterans and their families were still alive. In 1924, in the case of Robert E. Lee down in, the war was such a horrendous thing that happened to our country. Killed over 700,000 people, devastated the country economically, and... they wanted to make sure it never happened again. And, you know, these memorials are not to glorify everything. They are there to remember, to remind future generations of the horrors of war.
Back to 2017, Tom Davis, former congressman from Northern Virginia, compares Northern Virginia with all its votes. He says it's more like New Jersey than historic old Virginia. Where are your votes going to come from, do you think?
Well, I mean, my base is clearly it's going to be in Southwest Virginia, South Side, some of the suburbs around Richmond, Ann and Hampton Roads, also my home county of Prince William County. We will win that handily. But at the end of the day, Tom, it all comes down to turnout. It all comes down to turnout. And if Ed has a greater name recognition, a lot of that is dissipating, though. My name recognition is increasing, and it will steadily increase, especially after Memorial Day. And the question that voters are going to have to ask is, do they want the same old establishment Republican Ed Gillespie, who won't take a firm stand on anything? I mean, even the Democrats are bashing him for not taking a firm stand on the Comey situation. Or do they want a Republican who, even if they disagree with him, is going to talk to them directly and is not afraid of controversial issues? That's what I've done. I'm the only Republican who's been able to win up here in Northern Virginia, countywide. And I'm very conservative, especially on illegal immigration and other issues. And people respect the fact that I'm willing, at least, to take a stand and speak directly.
One of your Republican opponents, frontrunner Ed Gillespie, is calling for a 10% income tax cut and cutting the state workforce. The media have focused more on your stance on Confederate monuments. But
as we just did.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say it, but as long as you did.
I, for one, would like to hear more about your policy proposals.
Sure.
I've got this long statement, so don't read that long statement. I have it. But yep.
Yeah. Well, look, when I took control of the county board in 2007, we had taxes that were out of control, spending that was out of control, and we instructed, we directed every member, department head to come up with spending cuts at 10, 20, and 30% of their budgets that we then selected from those cuts, and we were able to reduce spending in Prince William County by about $185 million. We brought down tax bills by $400 on average in a single year. That's what I want to do in Virginia. That's why my tax cut is predicated on spending cuts. We're going to bring the taxes down, income tax in Virginia down by 17% in a single year. Ed, on the other hand, has no spending cuts, no specific spending cuts, nothing like that. It's all based upon this la-la land anticipation of unanticipated new revenues that haven't existed in Virginia in 10 years, and that's how he's going to bring down taxes. It won't work. You can't reduce taxes unless you reduce spending. That's the problem with his plan. And by the way, it's not bold enough. If we want to bring back jobs into Virginia, we have to make a big, bold move of a substantial cut in taxes very quickly. Otherwise, this gradual stuff, we're going to continue to lose jobs, especially to North Carolina and other states who have been reducing their income taxes.
There's been a lot of discussion about the Virginia governor's race, one of only two statewide races in the country, as a referendum on the Trump administration and the surge in populism that his campaign has put forward. Your thoughts on this current wave of populism, if that is indeed what it is, and whether your success rides on that of President Trump?
Well, I think that to a large extent it does. I mean, I think that Trump is elected because people are fed up with the status quo. And if they, I think they're so sick and tired of these standard talking points that not just Democrats, but Republicans have been saying the same thing since 1980. Like, they're just, you know, just saying these things. You know, we're going to reduce taxes, we're going to, you know, be pro-family, blah, blah, blah. But everybody knows now that those are just words. Those are empty words. They're going to be looking for an outsider in Virginia. That's me. I've been able to govern the second largest locality in the state, keeping taxes low, cracking down on crime. And I think I've done a good job in leading Prince William County, and that's why I've been reelected. And that's big county, 454,000 people.
The Democrats, you know, are trying to maintain control of the statewide offices. And I was looking back in Prince William County, and Clinton won Prince William County, Hillary Clinton, 113,000 votes to 71,000 votes for Donald Trump. She won Loudoun County. She overwhelmingly won Fairfax County, 355,000 votes to 157,000. If you are able to overcome what everyone expects to be Ed Gillespie's victory, how do you really go after the Democrats in November? Because the state has been trending Democratic for some time. And even the Republicans, I went to the Republican convention in Cleveland, and while he won the state primary, there was no enthusiasm for Trump. On the last day of the convention, the person who's leading the group had to beg people to put on Trump attire for his speech that night.
Well,
it's not a Trump state.
Yeah.
And as you love to say, you haven't said it, I'm shocked. I was Trump before Trump.
Yeah, well, and the point of that statement is that I've been this way. I'm not trying to be Donald Trump Jr. Right. I am, but our styles are very similar. A couple things to remember about 2016, the election, and that is that Donald Trump spent $3 million on his campaign in Virginia. Hillary Clinton spent $22 million on her campaign in Virginia. We are outspent 7-1. Plus, you had Tim Kaine on the ballot the home, and that we knew when that happened, it was going to be very, very difficult to win Virginia. And at the end, the Trump campaign pulled out of Virginia. You know, I kind of put up the siren call and alerted everybody to that, but that was the, so I'm not, and we didn't lose the state by that much overall. So the, yes, the state can be won.
5 points. That's a lot.
Well, it could have been 20 or it could have been 15, given the fact that we were outspent 7-1. I'm not surprised that it wasn't even greater. That's not going to happen this time around. The other thing is, I think the Democrats, they're feeling very, very emboldened. And I think they've been moving so far to the left on some issues that a lot of these social issues, I think that at the end of the day, people want somebody who's already governed and knows how to bring down taxes, bring back jobs. That's what I'm going to do.
We got this comment on Facebook from Jody. I live in Prince William. I don't think Cory will win it handily if he wins it at all. The best thing he did for Prince William was start things going for a new shelter. What does that mean, start things going for a new shelter?
Well, we have, you know, I've had to govern. I mean, a lot of, I get most of my attention for things like, you know, these memorials and illegal immigration. But the truth is, I've had to make a lot of tough decisions. And for example, we've done a lot of things with regard to the homeless in Prince William County under my administration. We've with regard to, you know, we're building a new animal shelter, which I think there's a lot of support for that. We've put a lot of money into parks, about $50 million worth of new park projects that weren't anticipated before and which I was able to find the funds for. And we've got the biggest road building program in the state. So things are running well in Prince William County. That's why I've been able to win in the general election. In fact, I'm the only Republican who's been able to win in the general election.
Three times. You've had, is this your third?
Four
term?
Times.
You're in your fourth.
Yeah, there was a special election in 2006.
Okay.
Which is a very tough one. George Allen lost Prince William County and lost the state that year. But I've been able, all these other Republicans have tried and lost Prince William, and then they lost Virginia because of it. But I've been able to do it.
Let me ask you, are you going to intend, if you, I know you want to say you're going to win the primary and then win the governor, but if you don't become governor, do you anticipate you'll run for re-election, or is this kind of the top of your career at this point and you'll do something else?
I mean, I haven't decided. I probably will, though. I mean, I enjoy governing. I really enjoy getting things done.
We got a tweet from someone who said, Corey Stewart said museums are dry and no one goes to them. Has he not been to any Smithsonian, Mount Vernon, or Williamsburg?
I almost said that.
I don't find them
up.
Dry, just we to, are in the so city, that Twitter knows. I don't
city,
find them dry at all.
We have a lot of visitors to our museums here. I live near them, so I can go to them on weekends. Yeah. But I didn't want to challenge that. One person did tweet out about your supporting of these Confederate memorials. It's so disingenuous. It's a glaring, violent insult to continue celebrating the domination of the region by white supremacists.
Well, they don't understand that this is an attempt to sanitize our history. And history is not always pretty, but you can't erase it. And when you erase it, future generations are never going to remember that it even happened. And what you forget, you will repeat.
One of your major campaign issues has to do with so-called sanctuary cities. You say if elected, you'll push for a law that would make it a criminal offense for any local, state, or university official to declare sanctuary for undocumented immigrants. The governor of Texas signed legislation along those lines earlier this week, but you're a lawyer. Is there any way for this kind of legislation to pass constitutional muster, given that even the president's executive order punishing sanctuary cities was halted by a federal judge?
Yeah, I think that it is constitutional and lawful. And I think that the Texas law, which has now been signed into law, is a law that we should replicate in Virginia. Look, if you're a local official and you go out and state, I refuse to comply with federal law, that makes you a lawbreaker and you should be punished for it. There's only one area where, you know, people, these local officials have been getting away with not being prosecuted for complying with federal law, and that's on immigration enforcement. There should be no difference. And what really disturbs me about this, Kojo, is there are some very dangerous criminal illegal aliens who are committing horrendous crimes. No one should support that person staying in our country, and if the locality refuses to do its job to coordinate with federal authorities to remove dangerous criminal illegal aliens, then yes, I think the local official who declares himself that sanctuary city, who says they're not going to comply with federal law, that they should be jailed. And $25,000 a day in fines and potential jail time.
My understanding is, and I've talked to people in many counties and states, is that law enforcement has no problem that if someone commits a heinous crime, a violent crime, they have no problem if that person is an undocumented alien of reporting that person so that they, he or she may be deported. What they have an objection to is that if you stop somebody, if say a woman with two kids in a car, and you stop her for a minor traffic violation, then you ask her if she's here illegally and she can't prove her citizenship, then she is subject to deportation. Or in another case, a woman is being abused by her spouse, she won't call the police because she's here illegally, as you say, and if she calls the police, it won't be that her husband's arrested for domestic abuse, she'll be deported. So there's a distinction between violent criminals, however many there are, and people who are just trying to live here in our country, even if they are here undocumented.
Well, see, this is where this misunderstanding is, and that is that local law enforcement officials do not have the authority to do raids on employment sites, to willy-nilly check people's immigration status. We don't have that authority. The only thing that we can do, which I think we should be doing in Virginia, and when I'm governor, we will be doing it, is that when somebody has been arrested for a crime, you check their immigration status, and that if they're here illegally, they do their sentence, and then you hand them over to ICE to have ICE do its job. We're not talking about having local officials just start raiding job sites. What we're talking about is local officials refusing to allow their police departments to cooperate with federal authorities. They're breaking the law when they do that, and they should be punished.
Earlier this week, Ralph Northam, Virginia's lieutenant governor and a Democratic candidate for governor, called for a cap on campaign donations and a ban on corporate contributions. Republicans in the General Assembly have not welcomed more modest limits, but the current state campaign finance rules in Virginia have been described as a free-for-all. It's one of a handful of states with no limits whatsoever on contributions. What are your thoughts?
Well, I'll tell you one area where I agree with Perriello, and that is, no lawmaker, especially down in Richmond, should be able to take campaign contributions from Dominion Virginia Power or any other monopoly utility. And here's why. For monopolies, they are directly regulated by the General Assembly, by the governor. And if you look at the records, Dominion has bribed almost every member of the General Assembly.
Bribed in the most political sense, sense.
In the most political sense, that's right. And that's why, I mean, how can you have the body that is supposed to be regulating directly Dominion Virginia Power so that citizens are not taken advantage of by Dominion? How can you have that very body that's supposed to be doing that taking huge campaign contributions? I think they're the largest political contributor, Dominion is, in Richmond.
But if you look at it that way, that's why people will say we ought to have a taxpayer-paid elections, because if you look at the legal society in the state of Virginia, the lawyers there have great power, particularly defense attorneys, when it comes to civil law changes. If you look at any number of things, there are powerful interest groups, whether it's the shipping industry in Norfolk, or if it's a cigarette industry south of Richmond, or if it's what used to be coal country in other parts of the state. Everybody has an interest. Why not just have it all publicly disclosed so we know who's paying who for what, rather than blocking people from participating?
Well, I think that the answer to that is, if you look at federal campaign finance laws, there are ways around everything. And
right.
the problem is that the only person that that it affects is the little guy. The little guy who can't hire the lawyers to figure out how to figure out all these complex federal campaign laws. And as a result, only the massive corporations and very, very wealthy people can actually have an impact on federal races, because the little guys stay out of it because right. It's too complicated.
I just think we ought to have more clear sunlight on, make people have more detailed campaign finance reporting requirements so we can know exactly who's doing what to whom.
Almost out of time, but we got this comment on Facebook from Jack. Great to finally see a Republican in Virginia taking strong conservative stances. Finally. The Republican GOP has continually tried to appease the PC police, and not only has it failed politically, it has done our state great harm in many areas, including sanctuary cities, lost jobs, and others. I think you have a supporter.
I think Mr. Mr. Stewart just put that on Facebook.
Yeah, that's very funny.
It's a tie.
Corey Stewart. He's wearing great cowboy boots today,
right,
though.
I'm the only candidate who's running who wears cowboy boots.
George Allen used to wear them. Probably not from Minnesota either.
Corey Stewart. Corey Stewart is the chairman of the Prince William Board of Supervisors. He's a candidate for the Republican Party nomination for governor of Virginia. Corey Stewart, thank you for joining
us. Thanks a lot, Cojo. Thanks, Tom.
Now you come in and see before June 13th.
Absolutely. Be happy to.
Coming up next is David Grosso. He is an at-large member of the D.C. Council. He's an independent. If you have questions or comments for David Grosso, start calling us at 800-433-8850 or sending email to kojo@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook. Watch the live stream on Facebook Live. Shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show or send email to kojo@wamu.org. Tom Sherwood, Mayor Muriel Bowser has decided to back off of proposed regulations that would force people who own chickens as pets in their backyards, well, to not own them, to force people who own pet cats to license them, and to force people who allowed their dog droppings, if you will, to remain in their backyard for more than 24 hours to be penalized for it. She's decided she's not going
to. Well, she's pulled back. This was stuff. The short story is the city health department, in putting together the 2018 budget, sent over proposals for it, and all of these things you just mentioned were in there, that the backyard chicken coops can be unsanitary and have run off into streams. The cats, there's a huge problem with feral cats in the city, and if you have IDs for cats, you can find out who owns them and get them back. But it got to be just too much of a mess. There was a petition against the mayor, lay off the chickens, which is a great line. And so she said, we're not going to go forward with it until we have some. Tommy Wells, the environmental director, said we'll have some community hearings about these issues. We do need to have some regulation, but this was pushed too fast. So she did pull back on that. It was a great story for all of us, though, because nothing else is going on in the world.
David Grosso joins us in studio. Do you happen to own any chickens or pet cat?
Thanks for having me on, Cojo.
He has two giant dogs.
I have two wonderful dogs.
They're giants. What kind are they?
There are over 120,000 dogs in the city. Only 4,500.
Who counted those? How do we know how many dogs there are? No one
knows
how many dogs.
Same way we know how many undocumented immigrants there are.
That's right.
Only 4,500 of them are licensed. Is your dog licensed?
Absolutely.
They're giant
dogs.
Okay,
then we can move on. There was news this week that the D.C. Inspector General investigated the top Bowser official, Courtney Snowden, the deputy mayor for Greater Economic Opportunity, because of a waiver to get her son into a desirable public school from former school's chancellor, Kaye Henderson. It's part of a larger investigation of special placements by the former chief. You are chair of the Education Committee. You were briefed by the AG's office earlier this week. The mayor now said that one name that may have been dropped in this investigation, City Administrator Rashad Young, is incorrect. But what did you learn? Names, please.
They didn't give you the names.
They didn't give me the names, and it was actually the Inspector General that did the investigation. And when he came in and briefed me earlier this week, we went through it, and really there aren't any names in the report. There are ways that you could probably figure out who it is by descriptions of where they worked or what school their children went to. And I supported the Inspector General not including the names, mostly because I felt like it was important to protect the children that are in the schools now. I mean, this is adult problems. The children shouldn't be impacted by it.
The mayor later today is supposed to release new guidelines for the chancellor, who has the authority to do any of these changes that have been alleged to have been done, so that there won't be any appearances of impropriety or anything like that. But I want to go to the IG report. I don't understand why we have an IG who can do a report and then say, I'm not going to let the public see it. What good is that? If you want to protect the names of the children or the names of the person who did it, blot them out. There's something, a word called redact. redact that information and let us see it. Right now, there's a cloud over every elected or appointed official in the city that somehow or another they have misused their power to get preferential treatment. I mean, I don't understand. The IG is only supposed to withhold reports if they have, quote, privileged information. What's privileged about somebody running the school system?
Tom, I appreciate your desire to get this report released, and I think that would be an appropriate action taken by the IG or the mayor.
And just to be clear, you were told, you weren't asked not to release it. You were told not. And I checked with the mayor's office, and they were told,
that's correct,
do not release this.
Well,
and left without written permission from the inspector general.
It says confidential on it. I don't think
it
a lot of reports
written
went out.
And, I've seen it.
The facts are also, though, that this has been referred to the Board of Ethics and Government Accountability for further investigation, and there may be some reason to protect this information until Bega has finished their investigation. And then at that point, I believe it would become public. And you can, I think, wait for that for a little bit and then see where we are.
David, let me tell you what cynics say. Cynics say that privileged people, whether by wealth or influence, invariably get their kids into the best schools. Is it suddenly a bigger problem now than it's always been?
I don't think so. I mean, this is a lottery system that actually works in the District of Columbia. We can be proud of it. The charter system, the traditional schools are all in this lottery system. This was maybe 7 to 10 cases where there was a mistake made. This is not, I don't think this calls into question the system that we have in place.
Go ahead, Tom. If you're staying with this issue, I was about to move on.
Okay, I want to reemphasize that we have a city where people now have, we have a school system that everyone says is improving, grades are improving, school buildings, billions of dollars have been spent to fix the schools. Then we have an inspector general who throws out a one-page letter for us all to read saying that the chancellor, who had worked so hard for the city for before chancellor and then during chancellor, that she acted improperly. And we don't get to see what happened. I don't know why the council is not more outraged about this and demand that the report be released or have the inspector general come over. The government operations committee is run by Brandon Todd. Maybe he doesn't want to get in it. He has other issues on his mind. But it seems to me we don't have a report like that saying it's not being done properly and then not release the report. I just don't understand it. I would be demanding it.
David Grasso, get outraged. Raise your voice.
You don't want me to be outraged any more than I already am.
Well, if I were an elected, if I were an appointed official of the mayor's administration right now and I had children of school age, I would be furious that this is being left like this.
Tom, let me just say one more thing on this. I don't think it's fair to say that there it isn't known who it was, too. I mean, and that keeps being repeated over and over again. DCPS knows who it is. DCPS knows who actually goes and asks for these favors and then actually who gets them. So there is knowledge in the mayor's shop that of who these people are, and they could release them if they wanted to. The people that actually got these favors could step up, like Courtney Snowden actually did admit it in the paper, what she had done. I think there's something about that.
Well, I think the inspector general works for the people of the city, not for some secret vault for the Seinfeld show.
As a follow-up to my issue that cynics would raise, we got a question over Twitter. Is there any D.C. school chancellor who has not given some VIP preferential treatment? That we don't know because there's no prior inspector general's report on this. But you and council colleague Charles Allen are pushing to defer the tax breaks in Mayor Bowser's proposed budget. Here is what Zachary in Woodley Park has to say or would like to know about that. Zachary, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Yes, Councilmember Grasso, I just have a quick question about, in your opinion, why does it appear that the vast majority of the council, including my own Ward 3 Councilmember Mary Che and Chairman Mendelson and the mayor, are all opposed to deferring the tax cuts? It seems other than you and Charles Allen, no one else in the council is in favor of it. So why do you think that is?
Well, Zachary, thanks for the question. The fact is I've supported these tax cuts now for a number of years. I was supportive of the Tax Revision Commission's work, and I appreciated the hard work that went into that effort. The problem I have is that I was given this year in the new budget process a budget by the mayor that underfunds schools, that does not do enough for school modernizations. And as a chair of the Committee on Education, I have an obligation then to look for money to make up for this. And it's true in the Human Services Committee as well. So when I start looking around, around, I started saying, well, where can I find this money? And it occurred to me that the best thing we could do is postpone tax cuts for now, maybe let them kick in next year or later this year.
They don't go in until January of next year.
Anyway, so you could postpone them for now, and then in fact, invest in the schools, invest in the students that, like Tom said earlier, you know, we have made great progress in our schools, trying to get them to be something that we're all incredibly proud of, and I am proud of most of our schools already. The challenge is, how do we get over the finish line? And by not funding our schools to the full amount that's necessary to do that, I think it puts us in a pickle. So I'm all for delaying the estate tax. I've even proposed delaying the business franchise reduction tax if we can't find other money to invest in the schools.
Well, you know, the budget is almost $14 billion. These tax breaks, which have been rolled in only under the condition that there's enough money to fund them, since the tax review commission that former Mayor Tony Williams held, there were labor people, business people, community people on that tax review commission. Severe critics of the government spending were on that tax review, and they laid out this series of tax breaks. And now, I think this is the last one that's in the list. There have been several of them. And now, with the city brimming with money, there's plenty of money, you just have to reallocate it. Why take back, why scuttle what was done so authoritatively over several years? The school system has more than $1 billion. Well, what's the annual budget for the schools? $1.2 billion? And, I mean, why not find the money in the rest of the government?
The challenge here is that you could find the money, and I think that would be the right approach. The problem is the mayor hasn't done that. The increase to the school funding this year was the lowest ever. And I'm working on changing that. And the way that I would change it is to delay these tax cuts and invest it in our schools. This doesn't mean that these tax cuts can't go in the future. So basically, the mayor and her people, the deputy mayor for education, have said that we know that schools are going to cost more, that it's not keeping up with inflation, and we're going to pay for that later. And I'm just saying, let's flip that on its head and actually pay for the tax cuts later and pay for schools today.
But you're imposing tax cuts to pay for paid family leave, for example. You've raised the minimum wage to $15. You've changed other taxes in the city, which are additional burdens. And Tony Williams' commission people would argue that this is kind of a balance and that you're upsetting the balance.
I mean, I don't agree. We've given, like you said, this is the last tax revision commission, to go into effect.
The last leg.
The last leg of it. And so we've already lowered the business franchise tax significantly. We've already changed the rules around estate tax planning some. I mean, this is the last thing. And
it's
I'm not saying
it's $100 million in total tax.
And if you want to talk about where the money's going, I think we should also consider whether or not we need to keep putting money in savings in the District of Columbia. We have, in my estimations, way more than 60 days of cash on hand. We're continuing to make Wall Street happy when we're not taking care of the people in the District of Columbia like we should.
During the course of this conversation, the words "the mayor" have been used a lot. And because Tom Sherwood likes to say this is the politics hour, rumors are always out there about who may be thinking of running for higher office. At the moment, there's speculation, maybe rumor, maybe even stronger than that, that you may be eyeing a mayoral run. Are you considering such?
No. I just was reelected as an at-large member. I'm the chair of the Committee on Education. I couldn't be in a better position than I am. I think it's kind of interesting that just because I'm critical of the mayor or critical of other politicians doesn't necessarily mean that I'm running for another office. What I'm doing is doing my job. I'm trying to hold people accountable. I'm trying to make sure that I represent the people I represent. And I think that's what I'm here to do. So
you're going to support Mayor Bowser's reelection?
I don't know that the mayor has actually announced her reelection.
She said she's running. She hasn't formally announced yet, but she says she is running.
But, I mean, that's always on the table, Tom. I talk to everybody about whether or not they're running.
Carl Racine.
I haven't talked to Carl about it.
Vince Gray.
I have not talked to Vince Gray about it.
The only firm statement is you're not running for mayor.
That's correct.
Okay.
On Wednesday, we had D.C.'s Housing Director Polly Donaldson on to discuss the revelation this week that the district forfeited more than $15 million in federal funds for affordable housing. Beyond why the city missed key deadlines, housing advocates are asking why that money was not turned over to the D.C. Housing Authority to be used for vouchers, for rent vouchers. We asked the director that question, and she said those plans are in place now, that there was, in fact, a two-year lapse between what actually takes place and when it is reported. And so that $15 million that we had to return dates back to policies during the Gray administration. Be that as it may, What is the council doing to address these issues, both ensuring that funds are well managed and used and the housing crisis more broadly?
One of the things that I pushed for a couple years ago, and I was glad to work with Chairman Mendelson on, is to create an independent committee on housing. We now have an independent committee, and Anita Bonds is the chair of that committee. And I think that she's doing the oversight necessary to make sure that we really dig into understanding how the different housing components in the District of Columbia can support affordable housing to allow us to not just build new housing, but preserve affordable housing in neighborhoods where many of us live today. Like, I live in Brookland. We've seen the cost of housing go up there tremendously. And what are we doing as a government to try to rein that in? Another proposal that I have on the table, and I'm hoping to fund this year in the budget, is exploring whether or not we should do a public bank in the District of Columbia. There's a public bank in North Dakota. This would allow us, I think, to take some of the money we have in savings and reinvest it in our neighborhoods, in our people, and making sure that we have affordability preserved in the District of Columbia in a meaningful way.
Can I note that I got a tweet from some person, Sarah Sipple, said she liked my tweet that at-large Councilmember Grosso says he will not run for mayor next year. Do you know who Sarah Sipple is?
No.
Would you like to tell us?
Sure. She is my awesome, lovely wife, Sarah Sipple. So she is, I'm sure, very happy to hear that we're not going to go through that again
very
so
good.
Soon.
Here is Tim in Washington, D.C. Tim, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes. A couple times the Washington Post has reported a $100 million cost overrun for the Duke Ellington School. And when I hear you talk about resources for D.C. schools, it makes me skeptical that if this kind of bad management, if it's true that there was a $100 million cost overrun, and also reported that it was wrong to locate the school there, what kind of management are you doing as chairman of the education system in the district?
Well, I appreciate the question, and
not
I think
chairman
it's
of
fair.
The system. He's chairman of the committee on the council.
The facts are that the Duke Ellington School is a unique school. It has both an academic high school as well as an arts program that is by far one of the best in the country. So the investments there were higher than normally afforded to high school renovations. But the fact is that it was, I think, a worthy investment. Should it have been less money? Perhaps it should have been less money. And in fact, we have been reining in the work that's been done between the Department of General Services, which builds these schools, and DCPS. And when I first got in office, DGS was running all of these projects on their own with very little input from the DCPS, the school system. So we've flipped that on its head. We now have three hearings a year on these projects to try to rein in the costs, to try to better understand where the money's going. And we put DCPS directly in charge. So they are now the client. DGS is the actual construction manager. This is more akin to what you would expect, I think, in good oversight, and we've completely turned it around. I've also introduced a bill that is going to manage and better plan for the future of school modernizations. My challenge is that we've done most of the schools in the city. The ones we haven't done are east of the river, and that's not fair. So we have to invest more money in capital projects so that we can get these schools done, the elementary schools, especially east of the river, C.W. Harris, Plumber, Ketchum, all these schools that also deserve the same high-quality engagement and construction that we've done everywhere else in the city.
I have a quick question. We'll
sure.
go back to Brandon Todd, your colleague on the council, who's had he's in a complete thicket of campaign finance morass. Why isn't the Judiciary Committee, which oversees the Office of Campaign Finance, or maybe it will, look into the fact that it now says the original documents that Todd's campaign submitted are missing and have been missing for weeks? They say, oh, well, we've got electronic copies. The original documents are missing. It seems to me that would set your hair on fire.
It is maddening. I've gone through two campaigns now. The Office of Campaign Finance has done a better job than ever before, in my opinion. We were audited at every single filing last time, every filing. And we also did a complete full audit last time. And we didn't have any trouble. We got our documents in on time. We made sure that they had everything that they needed from us. And everything was cleared almost immediately, like within weeks. And so this is baffling to me. I'm sure
part
that
of this is a problem. The Todd people, I mean, you want to say it as bluntly as I do. I mean, they submitted in
Right.
Insufficient information. Now he's put out a letter today saying that he's asked the Office of Campaign Finance to close his 2015 campaign. They don't close the campaign. Your campaign closes them by submitting all the information.
Let me just mention a couple of things.
The first thing is your committee look into this?
Well, I'm not the chair of that committee, but I am working with Councilmember Allen on campaign finance reform. I've also introduced in the past a Clean Hands Act, saying if you don't clean up your previous campaign, you can't run in the future. I think we should move forward on that. And I also think the Office of Campaign Finance should be moved out of the Board of Elections and over into something more akin to the Board of Ethics and Government Accountability, where there's real teeth in their oversight.
We have an email from Lauren, and only about a minute left, who says, AG Sessions has reversed the Holden memo on mandatory minimums and has also said marijuana is nearly as dangerous as heroin. What implications, long or short term, might this have on D.C.'s marijuana legislation?
Well, D.C. marijuana legislation, as you all know, is stalled in Congress. If we could get past Congress's prohibition on us acting on it, we would move forward with a tax and regulation approach. I think it's a huge step back with having Sessions as the AG. Just today, he made these announcements. And, you know, Tom's been known to ask me about why I voted the way I did on the police chief against the current chief. And I was the only one that voted no. And this goes exactly to that. I want a police force in the District of Columbia that is leading the way on community policing and nonviolent engagement with the community, and that's not what we're going to have.
And I'm afraid that's all the time we have. David Grosso is an at-large member of the D.C. Council. He's an independent. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's always great to be here.
That's it for the show today, but there's always more happening online. If you haven't already liked our Facebook page, what are you waiting for? You can find video there from the Kojo in Your Community conversation about immigration that we recorded on Tuesday night in Silver Spring, and we'll be taking to Facebook Live a lot more in the future. You'll also want to be following us at Twitter and Kojo Show, and follow at Tom Sherwood while you're at it. We'll meet you back here Monday at noon. We'll be exploring why a recent report sparked a conversation about the diversity of the teaching corps in Fairfax County's public school system. We'll also meet a locally trained actress who's now on stage as Lady Macbeth and the coach who trained her. That's all on Monday at noon. Tom, today is funeral services for Marshall Brown, a political activist in the city who worked with Mayor Marion Barry and who worked for a number of other elected officials, both in the city and around the country. He's also the father of the former council chair, Kwame Brown, but he died rather suddenly a few weeks ago, and the funeral for Marshall Brown was today. Well known.
Yes, and Marshall Brown is one of those campaign worker guys that you love to have in your campaign, and you hate that, you know, he'd be in somebody else's.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have. So join us Monday at noon. Until then, have a great weekend, everyone. I'm Kojo Namdi.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingelisa Schrobsdorf, Ruth Tam, Avery Kleiman, and Taria Rogers. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.